So God throughout history has used men and women that are unlikely, right? We saw it with Jonah, who ran from God and ended up getting swallowed by a giant fish. We saw Moses, who was a reluctant leader. Matthew, who was a tax collector. Rahab, who was a prostitute. And our character today, King David, who was an adulterer and murderer. People that you and I would never have chosen to serve was chosen by God. Why is this? Because God looked at their heart and saw something different than we do. He saw a heart that he could work with, despite their weaknesses and struggles. In our study today, we're going to look at King David, one of those men. Last week, Christy shared with us that David was chosen because he was a man after God's own heart. He had a life that was in harmony with God. He wanted to please God, and he had a thankful heart. Not a perfect man by any means, but one with a willing and good heart that God saw. We will see three things in David's life that God did in our chapters today. So if you're taking notes, write these down. First, we see that God chose David. Second, he prepared David. And third, that he used him. In chapter 16, we begin with Saul grieving over God rejecting King Saul as king. Samuel loved him, and he was heartbroken. Let's read verse 1 together. It says, "The Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing that I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I am sending you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons.'" So God says, "It's time, Samuel. Stop grieving. The nation needs a new king, and I have someone in mind. Go and find Jesse and his sons." In verse 4, Samuel arrives in Bethlehem, and we see that the elders of the city are afraid, and he lets them know that he comes in peace here. He consecrates Jesse and his sons and invites them to a sacrifice. Now, he wastes no time to getting to business here. In verse 6, Eliab, the first son, is brought before Samuel, and Samuel says, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." Samuel thought, "This one looks good. The search is now over. He has to be the one." But look at what the Lord says to Samuel in verse 7. It says, "Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." So God says, "No, I have someone better in mind." So Jesse calls another son, and then another, until all seven of his sons had passed before him, before Samuel. God had not chosen any of these men. Samuel may have looked at Eliab and his brothers' faces and physiques and thought that they were perfect. Why aren't these men the one? I would have thought the same thing. How about you? I mean, they seem perfectly good. Verse 11 says, "Are all the young men here?" Now, Jesse acknowledges that there's one more, the youngest son, and he's keeping the sheep, and this is David. So he's brought before Samuel, and the Lord says, "Anoint him, this is the one." God had chosen his king. Now, God had called David from the humble job of shepherding the sheep to being the shepherd over Israel. He had a shepherd's heart, and we see this heart in Psalm 23 and many of the other psalms that David wrote. If the choice had been left to Samuel or to you and I, we probably would have chosen Eliab. But probably that man would have become another King Saul. God knew what he was doing, ladies. Many times we look at people's outward appearances first, and we judge whether or not they should be in the position they're in, whether it's in the church or in politics or in the workplace. Are they well-educated, good-looking? Do they dress well? Do they have money? Do they have the right connections? This is how the world works. This is not God's economy. This is not how he works. He does not look at people with partiality, and neither should we. Outward appearances should never be our guide. Was David good looking? Yes, but this is not why God chose David. He chose him because of his character. The only and only God truly knows what's in a man's heart, right? So how can we even judge? We can't. 1 Corinthians 1:27 tells us that God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise, and the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. It does not say that he chooses the beautiful, educated, rich, and perfect people of the world, but the foolish. It's not that he can't choose those that are and have those qualities, but this is not the basis for which he chooses somebody. God's ways are not the world's ways. In verse 13, Samuel then anoints David here. And the spirit of the world of the Lord comes upon him from that day forward. Now we might think, why didn't God just get rid of Saul here at this point? I thought that as I was studying this, and make David ruler, right? He's already been anointed. He could just put him right in there and get rid of Saul. And obviously Saul had some problems. We're going to see that here. God had clearly chosen David, but God was preparing David. He was doing a work there. It doesn't all have to be one way or the other. God is always working behind the scenes to accomplish his will. Which brings us to our second point, that God was preparing David. Verse 14 says, the spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. So just as the spirit came upon David, the spirit left Saul, and an evil spirit replaced it. When the spirit departed Saul, a sort of vacuum was created, a way for this evil spirit to come in and to terrorize Saul. Some of my commentary said that he fell into a dark depression. Some said that he was demon-possessed. Either way, we know that God allowed it, whatever it was. His servants saw how troubled Saul was and suggested finding a man who would be skillful at playing the harp. This is going to fix the problem and make him well. One of the servants had seen David, and so Saul says, call him. And now I'm paraphrasing there, but basically the gist is call him. And David comes and stands before Saul. And it says here in verse 21 that he loved him greatly and became his armor bearer. At first, Saul loved David. And it's obvious that he did not know that David would one day take his position, right? And would be the next king of Israel. But he loved David at this point. That love would soon be replaced with jealousy, envy, and fear. And we see this next week in chapter 18. Now, last fall, we saw Saul start to decline, and we see how it gets worse here. But at the same time, God is preparing David for what he is going to do in the future. With David's presence mixed with the music, Saul begins to feel some relief. And it says here, whenever the distressing spirit was upon Saul, David would take a harp and play it, and Saul would become refreshed and well, and the distressing spirit would depart from him. So God was using David's musical ability. And remember, David was a poet and musician, and by the end of his life in 2 Samuel 23:1, it refers to him as the sweet psalmist of Israel. So God used this to introduce David into the royal court, and then he was promoted to military service. Notice that he did not instantly become king. And Christy mentioned this last week in her message, that it took 10 years, during which time David was hiding from Saul while Saul pursued him. God was humbling David, and he was working on his character, and he was doing all kinds of work in David's heart and life. Just as he does with you and I, or anybody that he uses. God prepares his servants. We saw it with Moses and Joshua, and we see it here with David. He is not anointed one day and king the next. So if God has put something on your heart to do for him, and he's not opened that door yet, keep praying and waiting on him. God knows what he is doing. We need to trust him with it. Now, God chose David to be king, then he prepared him, and next we see God use him. This is where we're going to spend most of our time this morning. Now, it's been some years when we come to chapter 17. Our Bible study book said 8, I believe. The Philistines have gathered their army to go to battle, and Saul and his men are encamped at the Valley of Elah. I'm going to say that wrong, but Elah, I think. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. Now this valley was not a narrow ravine, but a vast canyon. It was probably about a mile wide and opened up even wider near the mountain of the canyon. Now verse 4 says that a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. 6 cubits and a span, some say that's 9 feet 6 inches tall. Some say that's 9 feet 9 inches tall. Either way, that's really tall, ladies. This is like NBA. These men could not get on a ride at Disneyland. I'm just saying. My son is actually 6'2" and it's really hard to get on those rides when you're that tall. So if you're short, appreciate it. I appreciate my height. But anyways, Howard Voss said that the tall Anakim, though no longer existing in Israel after Joshua's day, continued to live in Gaza, in Gath and Ashdod, Joshua 11:22. Now, verse 11 says that this man terrified the Israeli army. He was wearing a coat of mail, and the Philistines would clothe themselves with this, it was like a heavy undergarment, like a canvas-like undergarment, and it was interlaced, overlapping with these ringlets of bronze. Now, this went from his shoulder to his knee, which protected him from the enemy's weapons, and it weighed about 5,000 shekels, which is about 125 to 150 pounds. Imagine carrying this much weight on you. Now, he also wore a bronze helmet and bronze leggings to protect his shins. Now, I have a couple pictures here for you, and this shows you how tall he was. He was very tall, and then what he was kind of wearing. And then we have a second picture for you. Now, this is the size of him compared to a normal-sized woman, and she's probably even taller than me. But you get the picture. He was very tall, and he was had to have been kind of demonstrative, you know, going up in, against this guy. Now, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, it says, and it had an iron point weighing anywhere from 15 to 25 pounds. Now, he also had a shield bearer, our verses tell us, who walked before him. The Hebrew word here refers to the largest shield used in battle, the size of a full-grown man. This shield was the size of a full-grown man. And so in addition to his body armor, Goliath had a guy running in front of him carrying a man-sized shield into battle. So verse 8 says that Goliath stood there, this huge man with all of his armor, and he taunted Israel. He yelled, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And you, the servants of Saul, choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then he will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us. I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man so that we may fight together." So Charles Swindoll says about this, what Goliath did was suggest a tactic commonly used in the Eastern world, a one-on-one fight. He would represent the Philistine army, and whoever Israel chose would represent the Israeli army. Whoever won his army won, and whoever lost, his army lost. Saul and his men, again, heard these words in verse 11, and they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now imagine for a moment seeing this giant man with his huge armor challenging you to a fight. Wouldn't you want to run the other direction? I know I would. Now, I'm afraid of a large dog when I'm out walking my little basset hounds. Like, I take my big can of pepper spray. I remember one year at women's retreat, the ladies were all frazzled. They came back and they said, "We saw a big brown bear or black bear or whatever it was." And they realized it was actually a black lab. So, but they were very excited about it. We're silly, aren't we? But the point is that a lot of things frighten us, right? I'm afraid of spiders. I'm afraid of snakes. I'm definitely afraid of alligators. I have a huge phobia of alligators. I won't go into states that have them. No, I'm just kidding. I will, but, you know, I take my pepper spray. No. But I can't imagine seeing this huge man, this 10-foot-tall man in front of me, challenge me to a fight. How about you? Now, Goliath would have terrified anybody. Remember, this man was a champion among his people, He had a reputation. Jesse's three oldest sons had gone to battle, and David occasionally would come and return to Saul and then return to his dad to feed the sheep in Bethlehem. In verse 17, when David is home, Jesse tells his sons to take a care package to his brothers on the front, an ephah of dried grain, 10 loaves, and cheese to the captain. And he asked David to bring back news of how the older sons were doing. So David rose early in verse 20 and takes these things and he went. Now he comes to the camp as the army is going out to fight and shouting for battle. As David stood there talking to his brothers, Goliath came forward and began shouting his challenges again. The men are afraid and they flee, and we see them say here in verse 25, "Have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he's coming to defy Israel." And then they tell of King Saul's offer to the man who kills Goliath. The king would reward the man with great riches, give his daughter in marriage, and make his father's house exempt or free from taxes in Israel. Yet no one from the army volunteered at this point. I thought that was interesting because they're all afraid of this giant. They're afraid of this man. They were too scared. So Saul was probably getting desperate. That's what I imagine here. He decided to make this offer because this had been going on for 40 days, as verse 16 told us. Saul just wanted to defeat his enemy. Now, Goliath kept taunting them, and I'm sure it was frustrating and embarrassing for this king. Now, in thinking about this offer, great riches sound really good to me. Especially, who doesn't want that, right? Especially when you have to replace your brakes or the tires on your car. That would be nice. Or your air conditioning unit, those big, I would love great riches. His daughters, not so much. We're going to see more about Saul's daughters next week in chapter 18 and what happens with that. But exemption from taxes, now I'll take that. Exemption from taxes would be nice. I don't know about you, but it sounds wonderful to me. Now, I feel like we're kind of taxed on everything these days. I'm just going to go into this a bit. Recently, we went to Seattle, and me and my husband and my youngest son, and we went for pizza at Pike's Place. And what should have cost us $35 or $40 was a $70 bill. We ordered a large pizza and three soft drinks, ladies. And I'm like, we should have shared the soft drinks. But then that's stealing, so it just seems wrong. But that's a lot of money. Well, because Seattle, they not only charge you tax, but they allow them to charge a service charge. And that was like half of our bill. So I kind of wanted to spit out the pizza afterwards. I was really upset, and I felt guilty eating it. I'm like, this is such a waste of money. But then property taxes don't even get me started on that. We won't go into that, right, or car tax. Well, great riches and free property taxes sound good to me. Well, David was very interested, but I don't believe it was because of these great offers that were offered, these items that were offered. Instead, because of the things that Goliath was saying to the Lord. David cared about God's honor. How dare they talk about his God that way, that Goliath talk about his God that way. In verse 31, Saul hears that David is interested and he sends for him. At this meeting, David says to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine." And Saul replies, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you are youth, and he a man of war from his youth." Now stop here for a moment. David could have been really discouraged by this point. After all, both Eliab, his brother, and Saul had something negative to say to him, right? But David's encouragement came from God. 1 Samuel 36 says, "But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God." God had called David to do this, and he was not going to be moved. Remember back to verse 18 that David actually had some quite impressive credentials even as a young man. One of Saul's servants said that he was a mighty man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, a handsome person, and the Lord was with him. He was not going in there with nothing, ladies. God had equipped him, just as he does with you and I when he calls us to do something for him. The enemy wants to discourage us, but God encourages us as we go to him and we rely on him, just as he did for David. So usually when we're discouraged, it's because we aren't surrendering something to the Lord, whatever it is, or we're feeling sorry for ourselves. We just plain don't want to do it, right? It's hard for us. And so when we focus on God, though, he encourages us. And so it's so important that we're going to him when we're discouraged and we're not just trying to do it all in our own strength. We really need God to encourage us. And so don't wait. Go immediately to him and ask him for his help. Don't keep making it okay for yourself to feel sorry for yourself. We give into our feelings a lot. But when we go to God, he will encourage you. David says to Saul in verse 34, I used to keep my father's sheep, and when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. I love that he caught it by its beard. I thought that was great. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. And just as the Lord delivered me from the lion and the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So David had experienced God's power before. He knew that the Lord would be with him again. God could use him because God could turn weakness into power, just as he can for us. Not because David was strong, but because God was. David had confidence in the Lord. Now his eyes weren't on the giant. His eyes were on God. Warren Wiersbe says, all of God's giants have been weak men who did great things for God because they reckoned on him being with them. David was a giant in stature, but God used him in a giant way here, and we're going to see that. Now, I mentioned Moses, Jonah, Rahab earlier, all weak men and women that God used. The person that comes to my mind from our time period is the Reverend Billy Graham. He was a great evangelist and born in on a dairy farm in North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, God used him to bring more souls to Christ than we could even count, millions, I'm sure. He came from humble beginnings, and he was not someone that the world would have chosen. He was born on a dairy farm. He was raised during the Great Depression. And Billy Graham knew that he was weak. He once said that God's strength is made perfect in weakness. The weaker I became, the more powerful became the preaching. God called him, equipped him, and did the work through him. Just like Billy Graham and David, we can do anything that God calls us to do when we go to him and rely on him. So whatever trial you are going through today, or heartache, or challenge, whatever God has called you to do, he will be with you and he will strengthen you for it. Joshua 1:9 says, have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. I think this was David's anthem song. He believed this, and we see him acted out in our story today. Instead, Now Saul gives David his blessing and tries to clothe David with his armor. We see that. And David can't walk, so he takes it all off. And I wish I had been there. This was probably a funny scene. My mind wants to go in and imagine different things, like he's walking around and it's, you know, ridiculous on him. But instead, David takes this stuff off, and he takes his staff and five smooth stones from the brook. He puts them in the shepherd's bag with his sling, and he draws near to Goliath. Now, Goliath looked at David, and it says here, with disdain, for he was only a youth. He was thinking, really, this young man? This must be a joke. He's no match for me. I am a champion. Goliath actually says here, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And he cursed David by his gods. Then he says, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Pretty intimidating guy. But David says in verse 45, and this is my favorite part of the whole story, you come to me with a sword and a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. Then he gives a pretty graphic description, which I won't read, of what he will do to Goliath and the Philistines. And in verse 47, he says, "Then all the assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." That last key is verse, "The battle is the Lord's." Then in verse 48, Goliath arose, drew near to meet him, and David ran toward the army. Then he put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck Goliath in his forehead. That stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. Then he stood over him, took his sword out, and he cut off his head. So when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. They should have surrendered according to the terms of Goliath's challenge, but they didn't. Then in verse 52, the men rose up and shouted, and they pursued the Philistines all the way to the gates of Ekron, and they fell. So David stripped Goliath, took his armor, and put it in his tent. Later, Goliath's sword will end up with the Jewish priests in Nob in chapter 21, 1 through 9, and David took Goliath's head and brought it to Jerusalem. Now, why is this significant? Goliath's head, as gross as this was, would be a reminder that David, with the Lord's help, that God would give him victory in the future as he went to battle. It was God that had given him and the Israeli army victory. Goliath's head was probably later taken to Jerusalem when he conquered the city and made it his capital in 2 Samuel 5. Now, this victory was not David or Saul's, it was the Lord. But God used David, a young shepherd boy. No one else in their right mind would have picked. We wouldn't have picked him, but God picked him and used him. First, God chose David, then he prepared him, and then he used him here. What are some lessons that you and I can take away from our chapters today? First, that God looks at the heart, not at people's outward appearances, status, or wealth. We should have the same heart. We cannot give preference to others based on this. Second, God is always preparing us for the future and working on our character. We do not always see what he's doing in our lives, but he has a plan, just as he did for David. If we are in a trial, we need to remember this, ladies. He will be with us and strengthen us as we look to him. Finally, as we fight our battles, the Lord is by our side. God will be with us, and he will strengthen us. He wants to use us in the middle of it. God has not put us on this earth to be comfortable. We have to step out in faith, and we have to trust him, even when it's scary. Our God is mighty, and he helped David defeat a giant with 5 smooth stones in a slingshot. And he can help us. Nothing is too hard for him. The key to David's success in life was not himself or anything that he could do. In 1 Samuel 6:18, it tells us that it was the Lord that was with him. The Lord gave him this strength, and that's where his strength came from. Let's pray.